Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Hello, I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey.
This is the first of our extra credit episodes on Strange Studies of Strange Stories, which are basically the same old bonus episodes we've done with HP Podcraft, but I gotta tell you something, man, I got rebranding fever. All I want to do is turn Megatrons into Galvatrons. I can't stop.
For this one, we decided on the film Mad God. Mad God is a Phil Tippett movie released last year in 2021. It's mostly stop motion, but it has a few live action bits in there as well. And it's really an 83-minute art film.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Tippett was the stop motion and visual effects guy back in the day. He was at Industrial Light and Magic. He did the hollow chest stuff from the original Star Wars.
Wow.
He did the Tauntauns and the Walkers from Empire Strikes Back.
My dad took me to see Empire Strikes Back, and we barely ever went to the movies together. I could count it on one hand. And that was one of them, and, you know, 1981 or whenever that. Movies played longer at the time, so it was not, I don't think it was the first run. But when that Tauntaun came out, he just laughed hysterically. he couldn't have been more tickled. And it was an odd, I'd never seen the man tickled before. Like a image from film really got to him, and he just kept chuckling. And later he goes, oh, I love that weird kangaroo that was running around. That was the only thing he had to report on about that movie. And I have to thank Phil Tippett for that, you know?
Yes.
He was born in Berkeley, California. When he was 7, he saw Ray Harryhausen's special effects classic, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. And his life's direction was set. Tippett completed a bachelor's at UC Irvine, went to work at the animation studio Cascade Pictures in Los Angeles, and got scooped from there for ILM in 75 for that Star Wars chessboard.
Yeah.
Which is also an incredible, you know.
Iconic.
Yeah.
He got an Academy Award nomination in 1981 for his work on the movie Dragon Slayer, and that used the go motion effect. The problem with stop motion, why it looks like stop motion, is that there's no blurring in the frames.
Right.
Because when things move, frames will have blurring depending on how quickly something's moving. So in stop motion, there's no blurring. However, there are certain ways to cheat it. One of them was to use glass and then smear stuff over the glass in front of it to make it look like it was blurred for a single frame, which was really complicated and not used very often. But there was this technology that he developed called Go Motion, which actually used mechanical armatures that would move while they were taking pictures. So it wasn't really stop motion because the thing was actually moving to get this blurring effect. And if you've seen that sequence in Dragon Slayer, it's pretty amazing. It looks pretty real.
I haven't seen that movie.
It's not a great movie. It's got Janos from Ghostbusters 2 in there. He's the Dragon Slayer.
I'm in.
And he led the creature shop for Return of the Jedi, and he got an Academy Award for that in 1984. So in 84, he left ILM to do some dinosaur animation because he was just super into dinosaurs. And he created this documentary for CBS in 1985 called Dinosaur! And he won a Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Special Visual Effects.
I'm actually pitching a gritty reboot of Dinosaur. Mine has a question mark.
In 86, he did the stop motion for RoboCop's Ed 209.
More classic stuff. And also, he did RoboCop 2, right? And the prototype RoboCops in there that they're introducing to, like, the corporate guys in RoboCop 2, also a cherished memory. When the one, like, pulls its helmet off and it's just a screaming skull.
Yeah.
I guess, like my dad, that was my only... I'm sure things happened in that movie, but afterwards, I was just like, oh, man, RoboCop 2, there's a skull in there that screams. It's delightful.
Yeah. I remember I actually really enjoyed that movie, and people say it's terrible, but I still have such fond memories of RoboCop 2. But this guy, a master, top of his game, he's doing dinosaur stuff. But there's a tragedy of Phil Tippett in this, because we're going to zip ahead to 1991. Steven Spielberg hires Tippett to work on his big budget, soon to be blockbuster film, Jurassic Park.
Never heard of it.
They were going to use his go motion technique for the dinosaurs, just like in Dragon Slayer.
Oh.
But then the computer guys over at ILM were messing around with 3D computer animation stuff. And they did this test footage on a dinosaur, and it basically just blew everybody away.
Yeah.
They just couldn't believe how freaking rad it is. So Spielberg broke it to Tippett and said, look, we're not going to do stop motion on this movie. This says here, he was shocked, exclaiming, I've just become extinct. A line that Spielberg borrows and uses in the movie.
Yeah, that's right. Sam Neill says it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you don't really need a guy to study dinosaurs anymore, that you've got actual dinosaurs. So that's a neat parallel.
As much as it hurts my heart, I gotta say that Spielberg made the right call, because the CGI was mind-blowing at the time.
Yeah.
I don't think the movie would have been as big a hit as it was if it didn't have that CGI.
Oh my God, of course not. It was revolutionary, and it still looks better than half the CGI now.
And I remember when I saw that movie in the theater, I went by myself in the middle of the day. Mm-hmm. I walked out of the theater, started walking down to catch a bus, turned immediately around, went back in the theater and watched it again.
Wow.
Because the dinosaurs, I was like, I just saw real dinosaurs.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Of course, there's still lots of great stop motion stuff that's being made out there. Tons of things, tons of movies, TV shows, all types of stuff. It's just things shifted, and it was a big shift, and he was kind of the apex of the big budget stop motion game, and that just went away. But Tippett wasn't fired. He stayed on Jurassic Park to supervise because he studied animal movement and he was an expert in that. Like, he, mm-hmm. you know, he knew his stuff, and there is some knowledge that could be transferred over to this new technique. So, you know, yeah. he was useful. He still did stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So he adapted to this change, and he did his own CGI studio. You know, he opened up his own, mm-hmm. and he did CGI on Starship Troopers and a lot of other stuff.
Casper Van Dien, he's not even a real person. Phil Tippett created him for that movie.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, he's that talented. I believe it. It's true. Yeah. But, you know, he still loved stop motion, obviously. This is something that was a passion of his. So this movie, Mad God, he actually started back in 1990 as a passion project, but dropped it because, you know, paying gigs came up. In 2010, he decided to go back to it, and he did a Kickstarter asking for a paltry 40 G's, which is, for a movie, nothing, especially something like this.
Yeah.
But he ended up getting $124,000 in the end.
I looked at Wikipedia just a little bit about the production, and I think it's pulling from a Guardian article, a recent Guardian article, but it said, like you say, 1990 started it during RoboCop 2, but shelved it. 20 years later, with the encouragement of members of a studio, he began working on the project again, utilizing crews of volunteers. I guess that's how you get that low price point. Yeah. On the weekends, I would get as many as 15 and 20 people coming around. They didn't all have the talent or skill, but I'd figure out the processes during the week. I had them do all the heavy lifting. With aid from these Kickstarter donations, he was able to create the first three sections, which make up about half of the film. There's a behind the scenes video on YouTube that was made about the production. I haven't watched that either, but we'll put it in the show notes because I'll be watching it when we publish this as well. I didn't know much about this movie, you know, typically for before we would do a show, I do lots of research, but I just decided to jump in and see it. Did you know much about before?
I saw some of the making of footage back when he was doing the Kickstarter, mm-hmm. and I watched the trailer, and I was excited when it came out, and I just hadn't got around to watching it yet. You suggested this, and I was like, yeah, great. Now I've got a reason to watch it. So no, that was it. There is a plot synopsis on Wikipedia, but I didn't get a lot of what it told in there, you know, from just watching it. It was like, okay. So I guess there is a plot, sort of. But to me, it was a series of vignettes that elicited thought and emotions.
Now, I didn't read this plot synopsis afterwards. I haven't read it yet. I still don't know what it says. You copied it into notes. But I thought, you know what? I'll just write down the notes that I jotted in my journal as I was watching it.
Sure.
And we can kind of go through it that way. And then you can kind of reveal to me what this plot is supposed to be. Because I wonder what's on Wikipedia. Is that somebody's impressions of what the plot is?
I don't know. I was thinking, did they have access to a script?
It
doesn't say on the Wikipedia article the source of this. So it might have been just whoever wrote the article. It might be their interpretation of
right,
it.
Right, right. There's probably a citation, but it said plot, which is pretty, you know, like as if we know. And there is a thing that happens when you watch something like this, Rico. What did it all mean? You know, the humans want to decode things. So there is a meaning to this, and I just need to know the right things to find it. Whereas I think it's impressionistic art, so there is no real way to decode it. There's no solving it. There's just, as you said, it provokes thoughts and feelings. And I did, however, think it did have screenplay structure. I looked at it. It's 83 minutes. I figured that's probably actually 80.
Yeah.
With credits. And so I was looking at the minute count to see if the act breaks were going to fall where they should. And they did. The opening shot, I thought, was really great. Humanoid creatures sort of striving at the bottom of a mountain that is slowly obscured completely by dark clouds. And that initial image that you show in a film tells you usually what do I expect out of this movie in terms of scope and action and feeling. And one thing it did was let me know it was stop motion, because you could see the little characters at the bottom of the mountain and the way the light was falling on them. You go, oh yeah, these are physical, real things. This isn't a piece of 2D art. That deep red coloring of the shot, the kind of chaos of it, I thought, okay, this is going to be bloody, and it's going to be the way the cloud obscured everything. I thought it's going to be relentlessly bleak. I shouldn't expect a happy ending. Which turned out I was right. I mean, it doesn't present hope at all. I didn't think, did you?
No.
Right after the title, though, I don't. What was your reaction to this? There was some language in it, and it was this insane screed right at the front of the movie. The words that came up on the screen.
Yeah, yeah. It was biblical. I recognized it pretty quick.
You recognized it? Okay, I didn't at all. It was like, if you go against my nation, revenge will come back on you sevenfold, and it's a list of all the myriad ways we're going to F you up, you know? My favorite was, your land will be so ruined that even the civilizations that move in later will be offended by it. It was very much like, I'm going to put a hurt on you that'll show up in your children. But I did think it was maybe original to the movie. And then the attribution came up and it was like Leviticus.
Yeah, that Old Testament stuff is pretty harsh.
And then we had this central character, this steampunk pilot that I'll call the Explorer. Was there a name?
Yeah, it's actually in the credits. He's called the Assassin.
Oh, man, I'm so glad I didn't look at that, because just calling him the Assassin immediately
changes things. Yeah,
it changes things because you think he's got an agenda. He's like a hitman. Oh, I didn't know that. I was just thinking this is like an exploration. The clothing reads as male, so I'll say he for the character, but I'm not sure if it's a male or female or has any gender at all. He's lowered from the sky in this vessel past, I think it's some kind of prison in the beginning.
It seems like he's in a diving bell, but it's coming out of the sky. It's attached to a wire that's coming down. And that was the impression I got as well. I'm like, so is this underwater? Or where is he? Because there's a rope that's lowering him down. And what I kept thinking about is, what is this attached to?
This diving bell. That was the word I was looking for. Thank you for saying that. It goes past the prison through a series of worlds. And that's when I thought maybe it was about the creative process, because one of those worlds was filled with stop motion figures, including some Harryhausen figures. Did you see those?
209 was in the background as well.
Oh, really? I didn't see that. Oh, mm-hmm. I saw Ymir from 20 Million Miles to Earth, and I think I saw the Cyclops from Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Mm-hmm. As he continued to go through these odd worlds, another question I had for myself was like, how does my mind know when things are small?
I know for sure focus is involved in it. So if you want to, for example, shoot a miniature and make it look big, you have to have the camera really far away and then zoom in. Because if the object is close to the camera, it'll look small from a perspective. I can't get into the details of it.
Know. That's one thing I didn't even think about. Right. Yeah. It's the camera. It's the photography itself.
Well, a lot of times with stop motion, the cameras are very close to the subjects that they're shooting.
Yeah.
So you get that depth of feel, and that helps you get the size of something.
My next note tells you how insane this movie is already. And this is from the first 10 minutes or so I wrote down. Why did Denture Man kill my invisible man worm? And why did it sound like a chimpanzee? That was a question I was asking myself. Because it did look like the invisible man showed up at one point, and then he crawled out and had a little worm body. But I was really pleased with the movie as it went. I'm like, this is this weird steampunk version of hell. It's so hallucinogenic. And I'm glad I'm in for the long run, because you said you'd seen it over a couple of sittings, and that's what the internet was saying. But about 17 minutes when these figures, and this was like the third time it had happened, where they were burning up and falling into a pit, and it had been these several violent worlds, that I thought, oh, this is why people watch it in a few sittings. And it was funny because as I was having that thought, Heather, my wife, was watching it with me, and she just blurts out, the futility of life. She just said that.
So there was these little people that were being made. They're kind of faceless. They look like they're made of fur or something, or like lint.
Yeah.
And they were being made, mass produced, walking around, and then just being murdered and killed, like accidentally by doing other things. And, you know, the machine would kind of eat them up and spit them out, so to speak.
Right. And if you're doing an 80-minute movie, you want your break into the second act to happen right there around minute 18. So it was interesting. I felt that right when things should break. And in an example of what you're talking about is one of those lint figures, which are about the most relatable in the whole movie.
Sure.
Or at least least monstrous.
Yeah.
There's a group of them who set up these series of blank dominoes. They're these primordial slabs that make appearances throughout. One of them sort of ends the movie. They set them all up in a row, just like dominoes, and then way on the other side, there's one figure there, just pushes them over, and they all fall back and crush the team that put them up.
Yeah.
And it was just like Heather said, there it is, the futility of life. Why did they worked so hard only to be crushed?
Yeah, and it just took one dude to mess it up. all that work.
And then there's just this really gross series of images after that. It went from being a little less of images of hell to just very physical excreting and vomiting and reconsuming of things into about minute 22. So I go, okay, we should be in the second act now. You hear this child's voice over a loudspeaker just babbling incoherently.
Yeah. If you have small children, it's when they're first starting to kind of learn how to talk, they'll just kind of speak gobbledygook. And it was that. It was a child's voice going, that kind of thing.
But it's coming across a bullhorn like an authoritarian figure, and there's all of these people marching around. So that first act gave a clear picture of a pointless world. Why would you move forward with it? And I felt like this was telling you, we're compelled towards creation, because obviously, you know, it is insane that you become a slave to your own children. In a sense.
Yeah, sure.
That whole sequence was really in touch with the visceral, the pooping and the excrete and the vomiting.
Yeah.
And that is rearing a child, right? It's suddenly you have to be really in touch with the grossness of our bodies.
Yeah.
In a way you never have before. You're gonna see, I think you described to me early on when you had your kids, you're like, I've seen poop come out of a butthole now. You said that to me.
I did, because I have.
Yeah. And that was this section of the movie, you know, it was like, this is disgusting. And yet here these people are going around at the behest of this child. And I thought that was a clear break into the second act. This is the reason that the narrative is going to move forward, because this explorer, or whomever the central figure is compelled towards this creative act. The explorer is in the deepest part of this place at that point, consulting this map that keeps falling apart. I thought that was a neat image that the map fell away as he descended. And there was this trap door, and one of those lint figurines gets a glimpse of him. That was neat, because it was like it was seeing a ghost, or it was having a Lovecraftian experience. Like, what is this other being? And then some monster comes and gets it. He goes through the trapdoor and there's a blackout. What was interesting is that the world did change a little bit, because then that explorer was in some sort of forest where there was these large piles of briefcases, and it was the explorer snatched up by a monster.
Yeah.
Kidnapped.
Well, the briefcase was just like his briefcase, which had a bomb in it.
Oh, man, I didn't think about that at all.
Yeah.
That was evidence of a ton of previous explorers?
Yes. Like, I mean, there's mountains of these briefcases. And so he opens up his briefcase, and you can see there's a bomb inside. He sets the timer, and then after he sets the timer, this monster takes him away, and then the clock ticks on the timer, and then it just gets stuck right before it would detonate.
I didn't get that.
Yeah.
So he went down to that, like, to put a stop to all this, maybe, or to...
That's what I inferred from it, was that he was going to destroy this mad world, and it failed. It looked like lots of people before him tried to do the same thing, and they failed as well.
Fascinating. Well, the explorer was suddenly vulnerable in that moment, but prior to that, it was a sort of journey of observing.
Yeah.
And when we next see this character, it's this backlit sheet. What would you call that? Like a scrim?
Yeah, and it's transparent, so the light is projecting silhouettes on it. So you can see silhouettes of him being basically disrobed and then operated on.
Right. For the amusement of an audience, you hear people chuckling.
People
and
are
watching.
Clapping and laughing and enjoying it.
This complex that he's in, where the surgery is happening, there's tons of these bodies around. So maybe that was the first time I got what you already got, which was that there were stacks of briefcases. But this has already happened to a lot of people. There's a physician and a nurse. And as the physician's pulling things out of the body, that turns into treasure. Tons and tons of gold and chains. And it's just going on. He shakes it in his hands and then throws it on the ground. And then these books start coming out.
Yes.
Also get thrown away. Mm-hmm. And eventually they get to this wriggling sort of simian maggoty baby.
And the doctor and the nurse in this scene are actual actors. They're not stop motion.
But they're filmed in an odd way that puts them in that world.
Oh,
I don't
know
what that is. Is it the frame rate that's doing that? Or
like they sped up. Like maybe they had them acting slowly and then they sped it up or something. It was weird looking, but they were definitely people.
Obviously, it's just the climate of the United States right now. But Heather says at this moment, she goes, look, they threw away all of her. She gendered the person, the explorer, as a her. They threw away all of her value and knowledge. All that was important was getting the baby. I was like, wow, that is exactly what happened. They didn't care about the treasure. They didn't care about the books. They just wanted that wriggling thing to take it to the, you know, the exploiters or whatever.
Yeah.
So, wow. The midpoint started about minute 37. After that baby's been spirited away, the doctor drills into the explorer's head and pulls up this view screen and then turns to watch, and we dissolve into static. And I took that to mean, okay, now we're going to get some backstory into why this trip into the depths even happened. He's going to scan the memories of this explorer. So we're going to track back in time. Because that was when the human character showed up, and this was actor Alex Cox. It was very clearly an actor with these long Halloween store nails on his fingers and toes. And I even thought, is that Phil Tippett? It sort of reminded me of the part in the Lego movie where we track back to Will Ferrell and you find out there's this human controlling that world. And so on some level, I was still thinking, was this about creativity? Was this stop motion artist sort of putting that diving bell down into the world of his characters to get the next creative idea? It seems like this human character somehow commissions this explorer or assassin.
There are these three witches and they have one eye between them. So similar to like the Greek myth stuff or Clash of the Titans, they make a new map and they give him the map and then he gives that to a new assassin slash explorer. In Greek mythology, they're called the old women or the gray ones or the gray witches, gray sisters as well.
I guess I missed that that was part of the team that helped him because they get a map and they have the ship and it's like they're commissioning this expedition. But yeah, I guess it's the Furies. I mean, definitely there's influence from Greek myth because my very next note is, whoa, that Minotaur is getting jacked off.
Yes.
Because there's that happened.
There's some explicit stuff. You know, there's two people and there's a Minotaur getting an HJ. So that happens. There was another creepy scene before too where there was a feminine doll type looking thing that was all gross and rotted, but it was definitely female and it was masturbating. And then it stopped and looked at the explorer slash assassin guy and then just kind of stared at him. And then she started masturbating while she was staring at him. So then he just leaves after that. It was really disturbing.
I thought replayable though. So he goes and crosses. There's like a 2D version he's got to take before he goes into the depths.
Yeah.
And it's sort of this war-torn Terminator landscape.
It seems to be a different landscape than the first guy that we had. And this other assassin explorer, whatever, is slightly different than the other. I noticed that their gas mask was different.
Oh, really? Well, I thought it was the same person.
No.
I think it is because the doctor's looking at his memories and then maybe you're right. I don't know.
I'm positive that they're different because the first one had a gas mask where the tubes kind of came up and over his eye a little bit, which bugged me. Mm-hmm. And then the second one didn't. The second one, the tubes went down.
Wow.
It was slightly different. And that's what I mean. I don't know if it was a memory or what's going on. It's all very abstract.
Side note, I enjoyed the score in this movie throughout. It easily could have been, and what I expected was a more abrasive Trent Reznor type score.
Yeah.
Maybe even metal, because obviously this looks a bit like a Tool video or something.
Sure.
It was really kind of light and ambient and very musical in sections in a way that made the images more palatable. The music was by Dan Wool, who's done a million things, but got his start in punk, played in the Strikers back in St. Louis, did music for Sid and Nancy and Repo Man. That was sort of the first stabs from that composer. So it could have gone that way, but it was very nice. I'm going to listen to the score again. It was really good. So we get this war-torn journey, and then right on time, minute 55, we return to that surgery where he's been looking at the memories. Mm-hmm. And the baby or retransformation of the explorer, whatever it was that was delivered, has been carried away by the nurse. And traditionally, that would be the lowest point in the film, the hitting bottom section. So we are back in the bottom of that journey to the depths. The nurse takes the baby and turns it over to this beaded curtain plague doctor. I was calling him the beaded curtain man.
Yeah, he's much bigger than her. He's, I would, like 20 feet tall compared to her.
Yeah, and that's an actor.
But he takes this baby on a really long journey through all these weird places, and he's just carrying it. So it seems very important.
Well, I thought it was this beaded curtain man takes like an abridged version of the explorer's journey, but back up through the depths. Because I recognized some of the places that he crossed, and there was that figure gallery again. So I knew it was going through the land that had already been descended through. So I felt like it was taking, the explorer came down, delivered the child, now the child's getting carried back up. Like this is a repetitive cycle of life thing. Yeah. As he heads back up, we cut away and meet this humanoid, I guess, mad scientist type. Maybe this is the mad god. It's a very puffy-headed elephant man type head with a beard and lives in these blazing obelisks. There's a change into some more beautiful imagery in this section. There's a blue world that's very pleasing to look at.
There's like one, like a phosphorescent world in there, which is the one of the few instances where I feel like there's a real color palette change.
I hoped that things could, because that's when we're going into the move into the third act. And so I thought perhaps we were going to leave some of this horror behind. Hey, let's see what this guy can do with some really fun, pretty avatar-like imagery. And then that was not the case, even in that even that beautiful world. Well, we go into this mad scientist place, and the first thing we see is that he's controlling these two chimp-like figures in captive masks. They have these weird masks and electrodes on their necks, and they fight with each other. Then he electrocutes them to stop the fighting, and then they go back to shoveling shit. They're literally shoveling shit into big piles. Yeah. It was totally the monsters are doing Maple Street. They have this horrible job that they're both doing, shoveling the crap, but he has them in opposition to each other as a way to keep them in servitude.
Right.
Obviously. One of them ends that scene by poking the other one in the eye. And then he's got that beautiful tiny world of color that you're talking about, but even that was a place of tragedy. Because you had a mother figure and a child figure, and then he released these monsters to take the child away.
Yeah.
And the mother cries, and it's to his pleasure. He's watching these war videos and things that look like porn, and this is all to his pleasure. I thought it was a little tiny, that beautiful world was a tiny microcosm of the whole movie, where it's just children being robbed from parents for the enjoyment of the one person who pushed over the dominoes, you know? Yeah. And then the beaded man arrives with the child. There's about 10 minutes left in the movie, says finale time. The mad scientist type, surprised me, took the infant and sort of destroyed it immediately, liquefied it, turned it into kind of elemental goo, but then it got converted that to sort of stardust, treasure. Which was returned then to the beaded man, and they floated into some kind of device that exploded that, and it became a whole universe.
Yeah.
There was this kind of big bang, planets and systems, and even a flying saucer going through there. Mm-hmm. The whole of the world that we'd seen before got very hyper. The clocks were rolling fast. That was the end of the movie. And it was pure cinema. You know, that something like that you can only make in the cinematic art form. You can't do a play of this.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that wasn't quite the end of the movie.
No.
You're right. There's the new universe. But that universe that gets made quickly decays into another ruined world. And this is from the Wikipedia page. And at the very end, there's clocks. There's a lot of clock imagery, you know, especially with a bomb that's going off. Mm-hmm. There's a ticking clock that just keeps going. And then finally it hits. So finally we get it to the midnight place. But when it hits midnight, a cuckoo sounds and it pops out almost like insanity. Like, oh, this is
what we're doing here is all insane.
None of it makes any sense. We see back to the, after that happens, there is a guy, we see the dude with the long fingernails again, and there's just a ton of these, what they call assassins in this script, a ton of assassins, like just thousands of them. And then there's a new bell going back down again. So it's just the same thing repeating over and over again. And that's where it ends.
When the cuckoo flew out, Heather goes, this is a crazy movie.
Yeah. And dude, actually, your synopsis was pretty good. From looking at what was on Wikipedia, you've got it pretty much right, you know, with it. There's other details that they talk about that you don't, but we don't need to get into that stuff. Go watch the movie.
All right. This is why I thought it was about the creative process. Every time you get into it, you got to plumb the depths, break things apart. Hopefully a new idea is born, and then it comes back to you and you put it to work for you. And it's this endless cycle. So it had a little feeling of that. But boy, in terms of it had a little of everything we covered this month. It had a little of the monsters are doing Maple Street when he's exploiting the two chimpanzee-like figures.
Yeah.
It had a little bit of Conan just in the sort of fantasy land of it. But especially in the chestnut beads, that theme that creation is an act of destruction.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Almost like that would have been a jumping off point for this.
Yeah, for sure. It is an art film. I guess I should explain what I mean by that. It's something that is not necessarily meant to entertain you. But it's intended to challenge you. I think that it wants you to either think about something or look at something in a different way or feel emotions you don't normally allow yourself to feel.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of just get into this. You explore.
Yeah.
Not just with what you're seeing, but you kind of explore. It mirrors back to yourself what it makes you think about and what it makes you feel. And I love art films. If they're playing at an art gallery, I'll usually go in and see them. You know, a lot of art galleries have little rooms where they show these short art films.
Right.
Even when they're bad, I still appreciate them and I get something out of it. But it is work. And I think that's why the short art film format works best, because it's a manageable amount of brain power and emotional work that you have to do as well. Like, you're feeling something, you're feeling disgust, especially in this film. You're feeling sadness. You're just feeling this bleak, overbearing, like, futility. And maintaining that for 82 minutes is not something. That's why I had to watch it in bits, like you were saying. It's just too much. And I think ultimately the film fails in that, like, it's just too big. And I can't imagine anybody just sitting there watching. You watched the whole thing. You didn't stop.
Oh yeah. No. Well, I guess I took a break midway through to get some snacks. And we chatted for a bit about what had been happening. But no, I watched it in one normal home rental scenario. I agree in that it was relentlessly bleak. I think that was part of the point. But it probably would have been a wee bit more effective if I'd broken it up just so I could take it all in. Because your brain does start protecting itself a little bit. The novelness of it wears off, and so I had to sometimes run it back and go, wait, how did we get to hear what happened?
Yeah. You seem to grasp it a little bit more. I mean, I could have told you all these things that happened, but talking about or hearing you speak about it made these things sort of make a narrative, or at least that's what we're constructing out of it. Maybe it's not right because it is pretty abstract.
I was looking for it, you know, and if you scan for plot, if you scan for those act breaks I'm talking about, you'll find them. It's a viewing process and you bring things to it. It is. I think that there's this sort of Midwestern thing that maybe people share where you look at a painting that's technically perfect. It's a recreation of a real thing, the bowl of fruit, you know?
Sure.
And you go, wow, this artist is very skilled to be able to recreate that with pigments. How did they do it? I have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah.
Abstract art, a part of your brain goes, am I being tricked? Like, is this person trying to get away with something?
Oh, they are.
When you go to an abstract art gallery and there's just a, you know, a sandwich nailed to the wall, I think is an example people use, or just a big, bold strip of color. And somebody stands there and says, oh, yes, this is a primal red. You know, it makes you, it symbolizes birth and death. And you go, yeah, somebody just hit a paintbrush against that thing and I could do that. And so there's sort of this, when you go into an art film, is somebody just showing me a bunch of nonsense images? And because I'm bringing an expectation that it means something to it,
yeah,
I've created this experience that I'm then getting built out of some money for or whatever. Well, I feel like that deep suspicion is why people maybe reject this art form a little bit more.
Well, I mean, this is different than that. For me, it's a matter of labor and effort. When I go to an art gallery and I see a white canvas with a red circle on it, and that's all it is, and the price tag is in the thousands of dollars, that I go, this is a con game. This is bull. You know, that's ridiculous. There's no, that is not worth that at all.
Right.
Because for me, it's effort. And like, if you can look at a piece of artwork and you can see something is being communicated and something, somebody worked really hard on it. And this movie, somebody worked, a lot of people worked really hard on it for a really long time.
Oh,
and
my gosh, yeah.
That's apparent.
Yeah.
Just on that alone, I think it's totally worth appreciating. But sometimes with abstract art that I've seen, I think to myself, you know, like Jackson Pollock.
Yeah.
Jackson Pollock. I think that it's BS. I totally don't. And there's a lot of people that agree with me on that, too. It's just a bunch of paint splattered on there. And there's people that will.
It is.
Go, well, it makes me think and it makes me feel. I'm like, yeah, you could look at what's spilled on the ground and feel the same thing. That says more about you than the only thing that he did was stick it on a wall and say it was art.
You say the only thing. That's a big move. I see, that's the thing. That's when you start getting in these discussions. I mean, what if you go through a lifetime, you're talking about effort. What if you go through a lifetime of art school, pondering, thinking, processing the world, trying to make something with it. And then you go, you know what? After the last 30 years, I've learned just a circle on a wall is the most beautiful thing in the world. And it was some life experience that got you there. Or Pollock, like you say, there's a random in an order to the world and a chaos. And look how I can just trickle paint over this. And by virtue of putting it on a wall and asking somebody else to observe it, they see a pattern or they remember something and a connection happens, right? You start going into that art world kind of thing where you think, well, there is something to this. And this man, clearly you're not being taken for a ride. This thing was made for a dime. Nobody's making any money from it. And there's a lot of intention behind it. And I kept thinking over and over as I was watching it. Can you believe people put so much effort,
so much work
into this giant butthole firing liquid into just something really obscene.
Yeah. Or even like just the sets, these landscapes. Because you've got time when you're watching a film like this, you can just look around, look at all this amazing stuff. I'm just thinking like how long this shot has got this whole elaborate background with all of this stuff going on. I'm just like, geez, how much time went into this 3 seconds that I'm looking at right here? It's just amazing how much thought, and he had to decide to put one thing there as opposed to putting it over there. And it's very impressive.
We've talked for about as long as it takes to watch most of this movie. Yeah. So, you know, watch the film.
I think it's worth watching, but it's gross and it's weird and it's very bleak. And if that's not your thing, do not watch it.
Yeah, that's for sure. At least it's not real. You know, it always happens when we're watching a nature show that bugs show up. You go, I don't want to watch this. There were cute puppies and then now there's maggots. How did this happen? But none of this stuff is real. So if you can keep that in mind, maybe it won't gross you out that much. But we should get off the horn. This was a good first extra credit.
Yeah.
It requires a little extra work from you, too, if you want to watch this movie. So it's true extra credit.
I'm curious to what other people think about this movie as well. So please, in the comments, let us know.
It's the strangest of stories. Mad God. It's on Shudder now. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey. And you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Extra credit edition exclusively on Patreon.
Extra credit.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.